ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, the government's pioneering social media laws came into effect today. The list of popular social media apps which now must, quote, take reasonable steps, according to the legislation, to stop under 16-year-olds from having an account on their platforms is effective today. The government's long voiced concerns over the impact of social media's addictive algorithms and endless scrolling of young people and the effect on their attention spans and self-esteem. The implementation of the ban is not seamless. A number of social media platforms are working through some teething issues. The eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, she'll be responsible for policing this. She's unhappy about the low number of pre-rollout announcements that the platforms have issued to users, but says she wasn't really expecting things to be flawless. I mean, for that matter, neither was the government. This is Julie Inman-Grant.
People will say that the rollout was messy. Well, it was always going to be messy when you're, you know, dragging the most powerful rich companies kicking and screaming into doing something they don't want to do. Mm. But it's the right thing for Australian children.
Opposition communications spokesperson Melissa McIntosh, however, felt standards could have been higher and that privacy concerns around the use of digital ID for age verification and other issues could have been addressed if things weren't being rushed.
And I actually think the government rolled out this ban too quickly, and the Minister for Communications and the eSafety Commissioner have started putting this sort of language in quite recently around it won't be perfect, please be patient. Well, they should actually just get it right.
Well, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, wasn't apologetic and was proud of the fact that governments around the world are watching Australia and saying, well, if Australia can do it, why can't we? And that the ban, even if imperfect, is having a positive effect.
Success is the fact that it's happening. Success is the fact that we're having this discussion. Parents are talking to their children around the breakfast table. Teachers, as we are speaking, will be speaking to their students.
And other countries are looking on closely, as we know. This is England's Commissioner for Children, Dame Rachel D'Souza.
France has banned phones in schools. I've been in Zurich, I've been in Paris, and everyone is talking about this and we're all watching you. This is a place where you've really taken the lead. So, you know, and I think get this right, where you lead, we will all follow.
Yeah, well, Greg Jericho, columnist with The Guardian and chief economist with the Australia Institute, with us again tonight for Nightlife News Breakdown. Greg, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Evening, Phil.
Australia's jumped in. We haven't crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's, but that's going to be tricky. Taking on big tech companies is not simple. Is the Prime Minister right just getting this far and the kitchen table discussions happening? That's success. That's the positive step.
With this policy, there's certainly a lot of good intentions, and that doesn't necessarily mean we're paving the road to hell. But one of the real concerns I have is that Anthony Albanese talking about the success is the fact that this is happening and that we're having the discussion that that's a success. I think what that really masks is the government doesn't actually have any sort of targets or any successful strategies. They don't know how they'll determine whether or not this is a success. Is it a success if average screen time goes down? Is it a success if there's a certain percentage drop in bullying? I mean, there's no real successful barriers.
These are all measures that you could use to assess success down the track. You're not going to know whether it's successful in 6 months, are you? You probably won't know for 3 years.
Well, I mean, the problem is the entire thing, I think, has been a bit rushed. There was plenty of criticism of the policy suggestions that actually it could do significant harm to certain sections of the community. And it was all sort of pushed out of the way of, oh, this is something, or we need to do something, this is something, therefore we must do it. And, you know, everyone kind of hopes it will work. But as I say, there's not a real sense of, well, what will working mean? And the government certainly doesn't want to suggest that there is any particular measure by which you could say, oh, well, that's actually been a success after 3 years. They the kind of setting this up as being, oh, the fact that we've got it in place is a success. And so, okay, but generally with policy, we actually like to be able to at least gauge after a certain period of time whether it actually has been a success or a failure. And there doesn't really seem to be that with this.
Yeah, there's a lot of naysaying about it, but you do get a sense with this that the government's got its finger on a button that the Australian public and particularly parents want pushed, don't they?
I think they want something done. Is this what they want done? Well, there was essentially some FM DJs who wanted this. News Corp quickly got behind it. Now, their motives are not always that great when it comes to the joy and livelihood of teenagers, especially in certain more marginal areas. And so it's a case of, yes, politically great. Is the policy actually good? Well, there's been plenty of concerns, not just in privacy, but also is this taking away the ability of many teens who don't perhaps have a nice middle class, straight, normal childhood with access to activities and sports that the Prime Minister would love them all to be doing? And, you know, also it is a little bit of a pig's breakfast in, for example, YouTube is still accessible because you just don't have to log in, so you can still watch all your Andrew Tate videos that do immense harm, but you're not able to go on Reddit and chat about your favourite, music band or TV show. I think my concern has always been this sense that social media is only a negative, only a bad thing. And I think, well, I can think just personally of the fact that activities like the school strike for climate, which got young people massively engaged about protesting about climate change, would not have occurred without social media. I don't think the government's going to particularly miss that aspect of it. And I think this is one of the things, yes, we can all sort of tut-tut and say it's a terrible thing, but there's plenty of politicians who are still using Twitter, even though Elon Musk is out there talking some fairly disgraceful stuff, and yet they then want to turn around and say, oh, actually, we have the right to determine what's good social media and bad. And,
life is really black and white. Black and white.
Exactly.
And issues are really black and white. Look, the government, of course, would have liked to have had Communications Minister Annika Wells front and centre, I'm sure, today. She was there at the launches, but it was Mr Albanese who took front and centre stage, because the focus on her travel expenses continues to be the only issue the media want to ask her about. Now, amid his excitement about the start of the social media for teens ban, the Prime Minister had to bat away questions about whether or not family reunion allowance rules need to be changed and the use of them by Annika Wells to attend events.
Minister Wells, for example, has three young children. She gave birth to twins while in office. I think it's a good thing that Parliament is more representative than it used to be. People have a long time away from their families.
The opposition still wanting blood, though. This is National Senator Bridget McKenzie. She's calling on Annika Wells to step down while the travel expenses of Annika Wells are being reviewed by the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Authority.
The ministers are now being currently investigated by this agency. She needs to stand aside and so that the government can focus on the social media ban, not on Annika Wells' travel issues.
Greg, you presume that she's had a look at these expenses and in agreeing to have them reviewed by the Independent Parliamentary Expenses Authority is pretty confident which way that they'll come down on this. Isn't she?
She'll get
the wave through from them.
My colleague and also frequent person who comes on this show, guest on this show, Amy Remakis, has often referred to Annika Wells as having very strong vice captain energy, and she's very good at making sure she has her paperwork all in order. Now, I don't think that's really the issue, and it's kind of weird that we're in a situation where the Liberal Party, currently led by Susan Ley, is actually arcing up about travel entitlements and such. Irony certainly has no bounds anymore. It It's certainly, I think, and there was an interesting report in the ABC today looking at who are the most users of all these entitlements, travel entitlements, and it was weird that Annika Wells didn't even make the top 10 in any category.
Annika Wells is not even in the top 10 of these, are she? No. What about Northwest Queensland's Nationals MP, Andrew Wilcox? $123,000 for family travel. West Australian Independent Senator, former ALP Senator Fatima Payman, $118,000. Don Farrell, the Trade Minister, third. And so it goes on. But Annika Wells was not in the top 10. No.
Yeah, it's very interesting who gets decided to be targeted and who isn't, when really the overall issue is actually the entitlements themselves. My colleagues at the Australia Institute earlier this year did some research and found that basically an MP has entitlement expenditures of around, you know, between $380,000 and $675,000 a year, depending on their level. And then you also throw in the electorate staff, electorate support budgets, and really what it comes down to is an amazing incumbency advantage of these MPs and senators, because they're able to use this travel allowance, use all these office expenses to, in a sense, help themselves get re-elected. And it's interesting that, yes, the Liberal Party are very loud about Annika Wells and perhaps suggesting, oh, it doesn't pass the pub test, but I'm not hearing much about, oh, we need to change these rules for all of us.
And you know what, Greg? And you won't.
I don't think we will, because they weren't too concerned about it when they were in power. It's always the same. I think there is a little bit of silly season aspect about this. It's all sort of really come to the fore after Parliament has risen for the year. Journalists are loving it because they're presumably getting fed a lot of really juicy stories, but yeah, for us, I think the focus should be on, okay, are all these entitlements worthy?
And well, that's the thing. I mean, these
and really is it? Yeah,
everyone hates these parliamentary perks, but you know, what's the way to stop them? And you don't get much cross party support for limiting them, I must say. We should note in passing that although Annika Wells was not in the top 10 of claimants. Hats off to Katie Gallagher and Chris Bowen, who spent on family travel expenses exactly zero. So there you go.
Yeah, Katie Gallagher living in Canberra makes the travelling to Parliament House not so bad.
She does live in Canberra, so family reunion.
Well done for Chris Bowen, though. That's impressive coming from Sydney and not engaging in that.
Yep. All righty. Look, Greg, can you put on your Chief Economist with the Australia Institute hat? And your thoughts on the Reserve Bank's explanations on holding rates steady yesterday. Predictable, most are saying. But is it the end of the rate reduction cycle? Is that how you're seeing it? A lot of people would be depressed about this.
I think they'll keep being depressed, unfortunately. It was a weird one in that generally when the Reserve Bank does what we all expect, which was keep rates on hold, you'd expect no real big sort of shocks in the market or anything. And yet there were, mainly not because of the decision, but because of Michelle Bullock, the governor of the Reserve Bank, her media conference after the announcement where she essentially said, no, I can't see any more rate cuts coming. And the next year's got to be all about whether keeping them steady or increasing the interest rates. And that sent markets into a tiz. They went from, you know, 2 months ago, they were pricing in two rate cuts. Now they're pricing in two rate increases. The market does like chasing shadows a bit, but certainly it seems the Reserve Bank, which has always been, in my view, a bit looking for every excuse it could not to cut rates, has now decided it doesn't even have to try and find an excuse not to do it. It's just announcing it's not going to.
No. The RBA Governor Michelle Bullock made clear the inflation bogey continues.
Before the next meeting, we will receive more data on the labour market and inflation. These will be important inputs for the board's deliberations in February. We remain focused on returning inflation to target, maintaining the unemployment rate low as possible. Our inflation and full employment objectives are complementary. Keeping inflation low and stable enables strong and sustainable employment growth.
I mean, While it's Christmas and it's the season of generosity and giving, Greg, we might say the Reserve Bank has made a reasonable job, haven't they, of managing unemployment and inflation?
Look, I mean, historically, you've got to say unemployment remains very low compared to what you and I certainly have been used to over our working lives. I certainly think they could have tried a bit harder to keep it closer to 4%. But, you know, I think my only worry is that it seems like if the unemployment rate does continue to rise, which it has been sort of going up and down, but more up over the past year or so, and we'll find out tomorrow the latest figures, that the Reserve Bank might just see that as a reason to keep rates steady rather than something that they feel they need to cut rates to try and prevent. Whereas inflation, they're looking for any reason to increase rates if inflation goes up. But I always feel like whenever you hear them talk about their dual mandate, it's always a dual mandate with a bit more bias towards worrying about inflation than the full employment aspect. Mm. But, I think overall they've done pretty well. I think the government also has helped with some of its policies, especially the energy rebates did work their magic in keeping inflation down when it was really at its peak. I think we're certainly historically doing pretty good. When you look at the GDP figures of last week, it's not like the economy is on fire. And no. My one worry as well is there's this sense of, oh, we need two rate cuts. Well, you only really want to two rate increases. You only really should be increasing interest rates if the economy is running too hot, and I don't think we're anywhere near that. I think we're at a pretty tepid kind of temperature right now, and hopefully, at worst, they keep them steady for a while.
Greg Jericho is leading the news breakdown for us tonight. Just finally, Greg, the AUKUS deal. Defence Minister Richard Miles is in the US for the AUKUS Defence Ministers meeting in Washington. We saw the lineup when Pete Hegseth and the Foreign Secretary of the US and our ministers, Penny Wong and Richard Miles, all said, yes, it's all full steam ahead. This is Richard Miles on radio this morning.
AUKUS is moving ahead at a pace. That's the first point we'd want to make. And the review has really been done in the context of President Trump's affirmation of American support for AUKUS. In using the words full steam ahead, he's really given us all a motto, I think. And that's in effect what we were doing anyway. The review, as we expected, seeks to look at how in that context we can do AUKUS better. And we've continually been working with the US and the UK on how we can move forward in the best possible way.
Although we still don't know any details of this review and what the doubts of the US were, don't we? I mean, he said he was confident that Australia would meet a deadline to host four US Virginia-class submarines at its Indian Ocean Naval Base in Perth at the end of 2027. In other words, Australia would be a base for US submarines. That's not quite AUKUS, is it?
No, and really the most important takeaway from that press conference was Peter Hegseth being very happy to announce that we'll giving them another $1 billion to help with their manufacturing base to help submarine production. And remember that the entire AUKUS deal revolves around America having a surplus of subs that they don't need. And the US Congress Research Department did a bit of a report into AUKUS and found that on the Virginia class subs, they're making about 1.2 boats per year. They need to get it up to 2 boats per year by 2028 and 2.33 boats per year to try and get to the ability to actually give us some boats. So we are a long way from that. And, you know, I was not surprised at all to hear America and Trump being in favour, because why wouldn't they be in favour? We give them all the money.
We continue to give them money. They don't have to, and they're under no obligation to give us any subs.
None whatsoever. And even if they do give us subs, they basically have control over when and where we can use them. you know, they can take them back if they feel they need them. It's an incredible deal.
Yeah.
And it seems, unfortunately, one that, from my point of view, that the Deputy Prime Minister, Miles, thinks is such a wonderful thing. And also, but I think the fact that all of them seem to mostly be just using the press conference to say how full steam ahead it was. Generally, when things are going well, you don't need to broadcast that, don't worry, it's all full steam ahead. You can actually point to some things, and there really isn't a lot of that so far.
No, indeed. All right, Greg, we'll leave it there, but thank you. Appreciate your time.
No problems, Phil. Always good to chat.
Greg Jericho, the columnist with The Guardian and chief economist with the Australia Institute there.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.